You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Kia ora, tēnā koutou katoa, ko Max toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpa Wednesday. I'm your host Max and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Flo. Fi Akine coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about what the Green Party has taken away from Scrutiny Week, the recent reports criticising the government's decision-making in regards to climate change, and the recent report released by the United Nations warning that New Zealand is at serious risk of weakening Māori rights in New Zealand. And producer Vihan spoke to the University of Auckland's Professor of Psychology, Quentin Atkinson, to discuss the formation of states. Flo, what do you have for us today?
Kia ora. I spoke with Lauren Craig, creator of Our Change Action Petition, refers to the decision to deny transgender and Takatapui youth, young people, access to puberty blockers, about the effect of the government policy on puberty blockers and the hopes for the petition. Furthermore, I also spoke with Kirsten Tillerman, a University of Auckland PhD researcher, about her study on discrimination and violence towards LGBTQIA+ individuals on public transport.
Hey aho o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki e ne kōrero anō. Hei pakeheri roki roki mā runga i te pai, tuku tuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
Last week was Scrutiny Week, where Parliament focuses entirely on holding government agencies and ministers to account to check in on how well the government is performing. Many of the questions around Scrutiny Week have been focused on climate change. Over the past week, there have been many reports highlighting the government's questionable decision-making in regards to climate change. The biggest headline was that the Coalition had chosen to reject all three of the Climate Change Commission's recommendations to strengthen New Zealand's emissions targets. Along with this, United Nations released a new report where they've warned that New Zealand is at serious risk of weakening Māori rights and entrenching disparities for the indigenous population. In the 14-page report, the UN expressed concerns over multiple government policies affecting Māori, including the disestablishment of the Māori Health Authority, cuts to public funding for Māori services, and minimising the role of Te Tiriti o Waitangi. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke to MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the report released by the United Nations, but first we discussed Scrutiny Week and the government's recent climate change decisions. To start off, what have been some of the key revelations that the Green Party are taking away from Scrutiny Week?
So from my end, particularly what I focused on is the fact that we know that the government has been declining people at quite as often when it comes to essential assistance that allows them to keep a home, to keep electricity on, for people who literally have no other option but to turn to either work and income or a private loan company that would give them a loan with a high interest rate that then they won't be able to afford. And what that tells us is that more people are struggling to make ends meet, but that work and income is using their discretion to turn people away and prevent them from accessing the assistance they need in order to survive. We've also did some work to expose the fact that the government is choosing to use financial sanctions instead of non-financial sanctions to strip people of support, leaving 13,000 people without benefits in 3 months, compared to only using non-financial sanctions 12 times in the period of 6 months since it's been in place.
How does the Green Party think the government has performed overall this year?
Quite poorly, because we see it on the streets and we see it on paper. Homelessness is on the rise. Our government is not on track to genuinely meet our climate commitments. We know as well that work and income is adopting the minister's toxic approach to treating beneficiaries and depriving them of the assistance they need. And this will have long-term harms in our communities. But what I do want to reiterate is that a different future is possible and within our reach. We do have the opportunity to change the government next election and make sure that these harmful policies do not continue any longer.
With some of the dialogue that we saw during Scrutiny Week, are you confident that the government will take a lot of this feedback on board?
Absolutely not. And this is why we must change the government and not simply rely on hoping that the ministers will listen to the facts and the evidence in front of them and to the voices of people on the streets. And this is why we are focused on holding the government to account in the halls of power, but also to start organizing for election year, to mobilize and organize with thousands of people across the country to make this a one-term government.
All right, just quickly moving on to the climate aspect of Scrutiny Week. There have been many reports recently highlighting the government's questionable decision-making in regards to climate change. The Coalition revealed last week that they rejected all three of the Climate Change Commission's recommendations to strengthen New Zealand's emission targets. My next question is, what's the Green Party's response to this stance by the government?
Yeah, Chloe Swoboda has been working really hard to put pressure on Treasury and Nicola Willis to basically be truthful about the impacts of climate inaction. And recently she managed to basically get Treasury to acknowledge and to do some work to account for the harms that not taking action on climate will cause. And for example, this includes making people's lives more expensive. And what we've also been pushing on is the fact that the government has two choices. They either take climate action onshore, so for example, by building interregional rail, creating more public transport, tackling our agriculture emissions, or they can end up paying billions and billions of dollars offshore to basically make up for the fact that we didn't take action domestically. Nicola Willis pretended that she wouldn't have to do the latter despite us having obligations to do so, and she finally basically got Treasury and the minister to admit that effectively these are options that are on the table, and they shouldn't be. We should be instead investing in things like rail and things that make people's life cheaper and better and also reduce emissions.
Officials have warned that lowering methane targets could increase New Zealand's contribution to global warming. How concerned are the Greens about that?
We're deeply concerned because this will make life more expensive for everyday people. We know that climate change will lead to more extreme weather events, that will lead to more flooding, that will lead to more people without jobs, without their homes. And we've seen that already when it comes to the Auckland floodings in 2023 and Cyclone Gabrielle. Many communities are still recovering from the impacts of those events, even after a couple of years now. And so we have to account for the fact that climate change is an abstract issue. It's here, and it's costing us fiscally, and it's costing our communities their livelihoods when we don't choose to act. And this is why we can take climate action, make people's lives cheaper, and also reduce the impact of extreme weather events that will become more frequent.
The government justified weaker methane targets by pointing to concerns from rural communities. Is this a valid argument, and how would the Greens solve that problem?
Long call for the government to do more and invest more in supporting farmers to transition to more regenerative forms of practices that help lower our emissions, keep our waterways clean, and actually create higher value exports to support our farmers as well. And ultimately, these are political decisions. We can keep locking ourselves to intensive dairying, or we can actually diversify our economy and invest in other parts of the economy like manufacturing, which will make us less reliant on agricultural exports and tourism as the two key parts of our economy outside of the housing market.
Legal experts have said New Zealand could be found in breach of international law because of the government's climate backtracking. What do you think about that and what it means for Aotearoa and New Zealand's global reputation?
Embarrassing for our government, and I think most people would be surprised to know that we tend to market ourselves as a country that is has good stewardship when it comes to the environment, and yet every decision that the government has made would tell people otherwise. And we're all seeing the impact of a lack of care for our natural environment and climate action. We're seeing communities in the South Island losing access or being at risk of losing access to things like clean drinking water. And so when we talk about looking after the environment and taking climate action, again, these are not abstracts. It's literally about whether people have access to clean drinking water down the line. And so this is why we must act urgently to support people to transition to a world that is actually cheaper, more affordable, and more responsible when it comes to future generations to come.
What are some of the main climate change decisions that the Greens are looking to change from the government's policies?
Well, we know that transport emissions make up the highest profile of emissions in Aotearoa, and we would invest in interregional rail, more frequent and free public transport so that people can get to work, to school faster, and also that we can reduce emissions at the same time. And as I've said, the other decision that we will make is making sure that we actually have targets that reflect the commitments that we have to the world and to future generations. And so we will make sure that then we take action based on targets that are actually grounded in science as opposed to just politicking by the coalition.
All right, moving on to the final topic. In a new report, the United Nations has warned that New Zealand is at serious risk of weakening Māori rights and entrenching disparities for the Indigenous population. In the 14-page report, the UN expressed concerns over multiple government policies affecting Māori, including the disestablishment of the Māori Health Authority, cuts to public funding for Māori services, and minimising the role of the Treaty of Waitangi. My next question is, what's the Green Party's response to this report by the United Nations?
Well, you kind of said it yourself, right? I mean, there's a list of government actions that have made those inequities greater, that have gutted services that help close the health gap between Māori and non-Māori. And what we're also seeing, for example, in areas that I do work on, when it comes to poverty and inequality, that the use of discretion by work and income ends up targeting Māori more than non-Māori. And this is why we're seeing, for example, more Māori having their benefits cut with the use of benefit sanctions. And we're also seeing that reflected in the statistics by the police when it comes to, for example, who's more likely to get charged for things like cannabis possession. And so what we have is a government that is actively undermining the rights of Māori and widening the gap between Māori and non-Māori through political decisions and use of discretion by our government agencies.
What kind of message does this report send to the world, and how does it affect New Zealand's reputation?
I think when people look at our country, often they imagine that we're a country that has decent race relations, that's a country that values our unique historical position and Indigenous rights, but the truth could not be further from that image that we use to brand ourselves to the world. We've got really serious issues that we need to confront, and we really risk harming our reputation as a country that could be leader in building a future grounded in Kotahitanga, where we all work together to look after generations to come and address historical injustices that have led to Māori being dispossessed from the land that they should have kaitiaki rights over.
Minister for Māori Crown Relations, Tama Pōtaka, said he had not yet read the report. What do you think about that?
I don't think he needs to read the report to know that the actions that his government is taking have been harmful and broadening the gap between Māori and non-Māori. The report confirms what many people here in Aotearoa have been saying for a long time. And so he's just turning his back away from the facts and the truth, and he's complicit in being part of a government that keeps attacking Māori rights left, right and centre, and widening the gap when it comes to wealth inequality between Māori and non-Māori.
One of the main aspects of the report is that they've called on the government to strengthen te reo Māori. Do you agree with that? And if so, what would the Greens do in that regard?
The Greens, for many elections, in fact, since I first got involved in the Greens before the 2017 election, have long called for te reo Māori to be adequately resourced in schools and to be made part of the core curriculum. Because we all know the benefits of having te reo Māori in schools. It enriches access to the culture for Māori, and it also creates stronger ties between Māori and non-Māori alike. And we also know that having access to multiple languages enriches one's education, and there is no reason why we can't value and treasure one of our official languages that Māori should have access to throughout our public services.
If the government's reputation when it comes to Māori rights is damaged, what are the Green Party prepared to do to repair it?
Well, we've been really clear that we are going to repeal the Regulatory Standards Act. We're going to ensure that te reo Māori is adequately funded. And we're also going to ensure that we put in place a policy of hoki whenua mai so that we can start addressing historical injustices and return land to Māori so that Māori have access to their whenua. And we're also looking forward to working in partnership to develop ways in which Māori can actually build papakainga and other forms of infrastructure in the whenua that they deserve to have access to develop.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on the Green Party's takeaways from Scrutiny Week, the government's decision-making regarding climate change, and the recent report released by the United Nations regarding Māori rights.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
The Wire.
The government is pausing the new prescriptions of puberty blockers to gender-diverse and transgender young people from the 19th of December onwards, following a similar move by the UK after the results of the NHS's CAS review. I spoke to activist Lauren Craig about the effects of the legislation. Her petition reversed the decision to deny transgender and Takatapui young people access to puberty blockers against the changes and the wider political motivation for the policy. Could you please provide your name and title so I can address you correctly?
Kia ora. My name is Lauren Craig. I use she, they pronouns. I am one of the co-signers of this open letter to Minister Simeon Brown alongside my friend Autumn Brown.
So what motivated you to start this petition?
So I am a transgender woman. I would have given anything to go through puberty blockers when I was younger, but unfortunately I never got to do it. Being transgender is, honestly, I think it's the thing I'm most proud of about myself. I think it's amazing. And I think it is abhorrent that our government would start making decisions to deny people the right to figure out who they are. I mean, it's not exactly news to any of us in the community to see the government act awfully towards trans people, but even this is just so cruel. How could I not stand up and try and do something?
What do you hope the petition can achieve?
I mean, fundamentally, right, our petition is to reverse the ban on puberty blockers for gender-diverse youth. This is such an important thing, and it's something that is so easily within the power of the government to do if we have enough attention and support and enough people coming in, signing and sharing. This is, you know, it was an order in council made. It was a regulation by a cabinet decision, which means it can be undone by a simple cabinet decision. It's not hard for them to undo this, and it is exactly what we want to do. You know, interestingly enough, the way they've done this, for cabinet to ban a medicine, like a life-saving medicine, and override healthcare professionals, is borderline unprecedented. They don't usually do this. It's just in this specific instance, they're doing it in this way for no real reason, as far as we can tell, other than to be cruel towards trans people and trans youth. This is something that is just so easily within the power of the government to fix.
What do you think the greatest risks are of this policy?
What this is going to do to the mental health and to the physical health of so many trans and gender-diverse young people is abhorrent. I mean, there is just so much that comes from, like, you know, the way I would describe it best, right, is for a cis person to understand is I would think of it as, how would you feel if your body just started going the other way, right? If you're a cis guy, what if your body just started, your skin started softening and your body started changing? If you're a girl, cis girl, woman, what if you just, like, started growing facial hair and your shoulders got broader, et cetera? Like, it's a living nightmare to have to go through this. And I know this because I did have to go through this. It's to directly deny trans young people this sort of healthcare is just, it's just cruel. What we're going to see, too, is an entire generation of young people who, of trans young people who weren't then able to access puberty blockers and are, as a result, going to have to live with that. So much of puberty is irreversible. And what puberty blockers do that is so amazing is give us the time to figure stuff out before we have to let our bodies change irreversibly.
Green Party MP Ricardo Mendetta's March commented that the policy is buying into imported culture wars, which you had also mentioned in your petition. How do you think these culture wars have influenced the policy?
I mean, as I said before, right, this is an unprecedented decision that has been made by Cabinet. This isn't how medical regulation is ordinarily done, which shows just how much of an outlier this is. This isn't a decision being made by healthcare organizations. And you can see that just from having a quick look at all of the healthcare organizations that have come out to condemn and publicly decry the government for this decision. I'm talking about organizations like the Pediatric Society of New Zealand, the New Zealand Nurses Organization, Sexual Wellbeing Aotearoa, and the Professional Association of Transgender Health Aotearoa. The other one also of note is even the Human Rights Commission have come out and said this is a human rights violation. It is a decision made purely out of cruelty for disliking young people for not understanding who, for not understanding who we are. What makes this an imported cultural right is the fact that it's come out of nowhere. It is a decision made against medical advice. And it is one that has been firmly linked to, by the Beehive's press release, by Minister Brown himself, a decision made in the UK called the CATS Review, which was a supposedly independent review of puberty blockers over there. Now, I say supposedly independent because it isn't that hard to have a quick look into the CATS Review. And like Hilary Cass, the independent reviewer that the review is named for, like, you can just have a quick look at her Twitter, and beyond the fact that she still has a Twitter as a red flag, you can look at the fact that she's just following all these anti-transgender accounts and TERF groups, trans-exclusionary radical feminists, just to see that she definitely came in with an agenda. It's a review that has been decried by a lot of health professionals as being very inconsistent and sloppy and cherry-picking results. For us to randomly decide that some other countries shitty independent review is something we should base our health decisions on, again, against the advice of health professionals. I mean, what can you call it but an imported culture war? So I completely agree with Ricardo's comments here that this is not us and it's not New Zealand.
That would have been one of my follow-up questions, is why we are basing our policy on overseas studies rather than what we're seeing in New Zealand, as puberty blockers have been used here for, I think, over 20 years in different cases?
That's absolutely right. I mean, this isn't some new unsafe medication. It's one that's been used for a very long time. You can read, there was a great article in the spin-off recently, right, that had something about the report of, in a study done in New Zealand, if we want to start talking about actually New Zealand evidence, it was something like 95 to 98% had overwhelmingly positive impacts of the experience of puberty blockers. That's what we call numbers right there, right? From a 20-year-old medication to, like, look at what we're doing here. Don't just come up with whatever that on earth the UK are doing. And even that biased review said that the decision to whether trans youth should go on puberty blockers should be a multidisciplinary approach between mental health professionals and the family and the GP. Like, they're going further than a biased foreign review. It's just hard to find a reason for this that isn't pure bias, a decision made for politics and ideology by a weak government that just doesn't understand and doesn't care for groups like trans people.
Sexual Wellbeing Chief Executive Jackie Edmund had said, I think as you had also commented before, that healthcare decisions should always be made by healthcare professionals. And so is this policy excluding healthcare professionals from the conversation?
I mean, it absolutely is. And again, I can't express how much it is. I mean, this is a decision made by politicians in the Beehive. It is not one that has been made by health professionals. So many organizations are coming out to say that, hey, actually, we are the ones that should be making this call. The idea that a politician should make a decision on a child's health over a doctor is, like, I don't even see how that, politically, I don't even see how anyone can agree with that, right? Like, it's a ridiculous position. There's so much support from medical professionals for us and for our community, which has been absolutely amazing to see, and I really appreciated it. So, yes, this is absolutely a decision made by politicians and not being made by health professionals.
That was Lauren Craig speaking about her petition, Reverse the Decision to Deny Transgender and Takatāpui Young People Access to Puberty Blockers. You can find this petition on our.actionstation.org.nz, and we will also include a link on the podcast of this show on 95bfm.com.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Here at 95BFM, we ran out of ideas for merch, so we got the kids to do it. And honestly, the future of graphic design is in excellent hands.
We've just dropped a 95BFM kids show tee, and it's been designed by one very talented kids show listener. Thanks, mate. We've also got staple tees and hats available to purchase. So get your summer outfit sorted and pre-order your 95 BFM merch now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
You ready to read your first ever ad?
Maybe.
Not nervous?
No.
Loosen up, you'll be fine. Just read the script. Off you go.
Tune into breakfast on Mondays. Hear about some books from some pretty smart people, and they love books. You'll hear about, like, books you want to read or maybe you haven't heard of. How was that?
Pretty loose. Let's try another.
It's Loose Reads, Mondays on 95BFM Breakfast, thanks to Time Out Bookstore, 432 Mount Eden Road.
Slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 53955 or call us on 309-3879. A new study from the University of Auckland has indicated a higher risk of violence and discrimination for queer people on public transport, especially for non-binary and transgender people or those with multiple marginalised identities. Kirsten Tillerman, PhD researcher at Waimata Taupaparao, University of Auckland, conducted the study and is working with Auckland Transport to address the issue. To further explain the results of the study and to describe the implementation of possible solutions, I spoke with Kirsten Tillerman. So, what do safety hazards on public transport look like for queer people?
So, for queer folks, you've got all the same hazards that everyone who rides public transport looks at with additional layers. Because queer folks can be read as that in public life, that can mean people are targeting them for challenging gender norms, for being out with a partner that doesn't fit binary or heterosexual norms. It can mean for trans folks, challenging those gender norms, maybe having a voice that is not expected, and just basically for living our authentic selves, being out on public transport, it can mean that we're targeted for different reasons that are driven by transphobia, homophobia, those rigid gender norms, all the isms on top of what's there already.
So what inspired you to start the study and focus on this issue?
Well, the first study that I did on bystanders looked gathered input from women in general, and I found that there seemed to be also some differences coming from my participants in that study who identified as part of the Rainbow community, but I didn't quite have enough information to really dig into that. So the next study I designed, I wanted to specifically do it within the community and be as inclusive about that as possible, because I found that there's not actually a lot of information out there about the experiences of the Rainbow community of harassment and other forms of violence on public transport. And so this was an attempt to help fill some of that data gap and therefore help public transport authorities and professionals make better informed decisions about the programs that they design.
Within your findings, is there a time period, for example, on weekends or certain times of year where the violence is found to be worse?
I can't say that in a quantitative way because this was a qualitative study, but as is probably not surprising, participants did talk about generally feeling a lot less comfortable during darker hours, during the nighttime. And there was also kind of a two sides of the same coin conversation around Pride Month, where it was nice to see a bit of like visual support for the Rainbow community, but also this kind of sense of unease that it might make folks just a bit more aware of it, and folks that are triggered by that sort of thing more likely to actually target people during Pride Month. So it's all contextual, but there are some patterns there.
In your study, you have analyzed how marginalized communities are more at risk of violence, especially queer communities. Yet responses usually do not focus on these communities. What would a response focused on Rainbow riders look like?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I think was so amazing to hear from my participants is that the queer community is very trained or very experienced at looking at bigger pictures and looking at more layered approaches. So it's not just that we need to respond to making sure that we see representation in the posters or the communications that go out that very clearly communicate that protections include the queer community and everyone, but also that it's not just lip service. So we talked about this systematic approach, this community-based, so that there's this shared responsibility for safety around it. And I thought that was something, I found that was really unique in the conversations around this, of this shared responsibility, not just only these are the things that public transport agencies need to do, which is true, but also what we can bring as riders and as a community to be able to look out for each other and create an environment where it's harassment that's not welcomed on transport, not people who are typically marginalized by society. We want to welcome those folks on public transport.
So that was part of the active bystander approach, I believe, that you'd mentioned in your study, trying to get other riders, I guess, to show more solidarity. How do you think we can encourage the solidarity in action from other passengers?
Yeah, well, I think it definitely has to come from not only the community, but there has to be public transport authority tools in place first. So I'm never going to tell someone to put themselves in harm's way, but the public transport authority, if there are ways to report incidences as they're happening, that is one way. You can be an active bystander without actually getting actively involved, but there that pathway has to be in place. There's also ways to have more resources like transport staff available on hand, and help buttons, and then the staff to have training as well. So inclusive service training and de-escalation. And then once those are in place, then there's also an avenue to provide more information about how passengers and riders can step in without putting themselves, again, in harm's way. That's indirect approaches like causing distractions or going up and talking to the person who's being harassed, ignoring the perpetrator so you're not escalating anything, or just stepping in between a situation to block that line of sight often can just diffuse something that's starting to escalate. But that all requires first assessing the situation for danger and to assess what you feel comfortable doing as well. And that might just mean recording what's going on so that you can have an account of it to provide after the fact, or checking in with the person after the fact if it was something that happened quickly.
So I'm guessing that's part of the systems level approach. At the same time, work from the community itself as well as from the public transport agency.
Yeah, absolutely. That sort of shared responsibility where the public transport authority is saying, these are the things that we provide for you. These are safety tools. We're also going to get you from point A to point B. We've got your back. We understand that these things happen. We're going to take them seriously. And we also expect this type of behavior from you. And if we see that that is breached, we're going to come up, back up and enforce it in kind of a tiered way. Like, obviously, if it's like not everything demands like kicking someone off the system or calling in police, but like handling things in a step up sort of way.
Is there more violence on public transport compared to, let's say, just on the street in the evening?
In general, like, I don't have the like quantitative data to say that specifically, especially like specifically here in Auckland. But in general, what we see on public transport is just reflective of the risks that you see outside. So I would say that it's not more risky to be on public transport. Now, it's just a different, slightly different situation, because if you're out on the street, for instance, you have a little bit more option to leave. You can move. If you're on like a moving vehicle, you can't just jump off a moving vehicle. At the same time, when you're on public transport, there might be other protections in place, because you have, if it's a bus, there is a bus driver there. There might be other riders there. So it's kind of a give and take. But in general, I would not say it's more risky on public transport than out on the street. They're kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, and you're currently working with Auckland Transport on safety initiatives. What kind of time frame were you looking at there? When are you hoping that some of your new ideas and initiatives might be implemented?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, I'm to disappoint. I can't give a specific timeline outside of my control, but I can say that I have been working with Auckland Transport over the last about year. And the reason why you haven't seen anything like bright and flashy and like huge changes right away is because Auckland Transport's wanting to do it right. They're not just wanting to be able to say, oh, we did this, without actually having the systems in place behind the scenes to back that up. So they're taking a systematic approach to make sure that they have those systems in place. They've cataloged what's already there and are starting to put out communications for that. They're also exploring options for adding additional measures, and then making sure that as they're designing those, we're getting input from a diverse community of riders. The hope is next year you'll start seeing things. I'd feel comfortable saying next year in 2026.
That was Kirsten Tilleman, PhD researcher at Waimata Taupapa Rau, University of Auckland, speaking about her study on violence and discrimination of queer people on public transport. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
On the floor, glitter on the wet streets. Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Once again, please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879. We might think of statehood as a fairly recent post-World War II phenomenon, but the creation of states actually goes back to 5,000 years ago. And instead of money, it was the taxation of grains that contributed to the creation of the first states. Producer Vihan spoke to the University of Auckland's Professor of Psychology, Quentin Atkinson, on how the first states and their elites came to be.
So, Professor Quentin, can you just tell us a bit about your study?
Yeah, so this is a study that seeks to try to understand some of the factors involved in a big change that happened over the last 10,000 years in the scale of human social organization, namely the emergence of large states, really big groups of people with political hierarchies. And in a nutshell, we wanted to test some ideas about what drove that transition to statehood. Some have argued that it's the increased resource production associated with agriculture and what's called agricultural intensification, so producing just a lot of food that allows the population to grow, and then you get states emerging from that. But another proposal is that it's not just agricultural intensification that's important, it's the kind of agriculture you're doing. And in particular, if you're growing grains, that might be really important for driving the emergence of states. And the theory there is that what makes grains special is that they grow above the ground where everyone can see. And so you kind of know what's coming. You can't run away with them while they're growing. And when they're ready, you can't leave them. When it's time to harvest them, they have to be harvested. So what this means is there are kind of visible large resources available at a particular time that can be acquired by a powerful state and taxed. And so they're basically taxable. Social scientist James C. Scott has this book called Against the Grain, where he makes the argument that it's grain agriculture that was key to the emergence of states. And what we try and do in the paper is test these ideas. Is it agriculture in general, or is it grain in particular that's important?
So now, in your piece for The Conversation, you mentioned that states were formed due to an intensification of agriculture. So what did that actually look like?
So intensification of agriculture definitely goes along with the emergence of states, and that can take different forms. Basically, it's extracting more crops or food from the land than more traditional approaches where you leave the land fallow for long periods. For example, using fertilizer or irrigation as a form of intensification, artificially ensuring there's the right amount of water all the time. This can extend the growing season or allow for year upon year use of the same plot. It's called intensification, and that is linked to the emergence of states. Their causality there is a bit unclear. Is it that you get the intensification and then you get states? So the extra resources allow the emergence of states? Or is it that states and everything they come with, all the resources and power, allow you to intensify your agriculture? And we found that it kind of goes both ways. So it wasn't clearly the case that states only follow from intensification. And like I said, there's this other theory that, well, maybe it's not intensification, but maybe it's grains in particular that are key. And we found more support for a model looked at whether the agriculture was grain agriculture or not.
So what was the need to begin taxing grain in the first place?
I think the argument is that you can, that there's where there's an elite, they can essentially extort more grain or resources from the population this way, and then increase their power. They can invest that back in the state, and they do, but that it's the kind of aspirations for wealth and power of the elite that drive the taxation.
The article also mentioned that any surplus of grains could be used by the elites to maintain the state. So how was this group of elite actually formed all the way back then?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's not something we tested in this paper, but so you get societies forming these different power structures, and they can rely on heredity, so like kin groups. You can get more or less powerful king groups. They can also appeal to having like divine connections, so kind of supernatural endorsement, and maybe use the threat of supernatural punishment as a way of enforcing their position. And I suppose there's also just an element of politics, just like, you know, individuals can gain political advantage in any human society. Anthropologists make a distinction between what they call big man societies, where there isn't a kind of such a clear institutionalized structure of power, and states are different to that. They have these institutional roles and offices with hereditary power structures that allow elites to maintain their control.
Was the agriculture of grain the determining factor in the creation of a nation state, or was it the taxing of the grain that led to its creation?
These are super complex phenomena that play out over generations, and there's all kinds of feedback loops involved. So I don't think you can kind of draw this as like a simple stepwise thing. But what we found support for, so the basic approach we used was to build a big family tree of all the world's languages. And we know there's thousands of languages, but we had data on over 1,000 of them, looking at whether or not they have this hierarchical political structure that we associate with statehood, and all the agricultural practices and other things, some other variables that characterize each society that speaks each language. And then we have this model of how all this evolves or co-evolves along the branches of this global family tree. And so what you can do with methods like that is look at how well different models explain the data you see today, assuming that they've evolved, that the traits have evolved along the branches of this tree. And we compared different models, and we found that models in which a lineage had grain, they were more likely to transition to statehood than lineages that didn't have grain. So that we take as some evidence that grain plays a role. There's also evidence for an association with agricultural intensification generally, but the intensification tended to follow rather than precede the statehood. So that favors the explanation that it's grain that's playing a role. We also find an association between grain and taxation and statehood. And the sequence does fit this idea that you get grain driving statehood and statehood sustaining, or taxation, sorry, sustaining statehood. But one of the limitations of the method is you can only look at pairs of traits at a time in this particular framework. And so we can't kind of sketch out the entire probably complex causal sequence. All we can say is that these things are associated and it looks like one's preceding the other, which fits with this fairly well-developed theory from James C. Scott, who I mentioned earlier.
So to what extent have nation states historically depended on hierarchies to maintain law and order?
Yeah, well, I think they have. There's a power structure there that is in a hierarchy. The way we define statehood in this paper is having a certain number of levels in the hierarchy. So you have sometimes called acephalous societies that are egalitarian and don't have a power structure. Acephalous literally translates as, or means, without a head. Then you can get what are sometimes called petty chiefdoms. So they have you've got general population and then a chief above that. Then you've got big chiefdoms or grand chiefdoms that have a grand chief that sits above the little chiefs. So you've got two levels of a hierarchy. And more than that, you can get three levels, the statehood. And so it's kind of built into our definition of states that there's these levels in the hierarchy. But that's an assumption that that's what states look like in our method. But it is because generally you can't have a state without that kind of hierarchical structure of leaders and sub-leaders and so on. So that's definitely used. It's not always an exclusively political hierarchy. It can be kind of tied in with the religious hierarchy as well. And yeah, that's kind of integral to large-scale human cooperation, is that kind of hierarchy.
What sort of change will we need to see on the judicial and policy front to make society more egalitarian and non-hierarchical?
I would say there's a couple of slightly different things going on there. So hierarchy is not necessarily a bad thing if you need to organize a large number of people. I think a bigger concern is whether that hierarchy is fair and just and has the support of most people. So like democracies are good for that. Was it Winston Churchill said that they're actually problematic in many ways, but they're better than any other system. So what needs to change there? I don't think we need radical change. We just need to implement the institutions we know work better. So for example, democracy, we have democracies working in name, but maybe not in practice. The United States is a good example of that. For example, the money involved in the elections mean that it's become a kind of autocracy. So yeah, I think just critically examining not so much the ideal institutions that we want to put together, which I think we do have some pretty good ideas about, but whether in practice we are meeting those ideals. And you mentioned get more egalitarian. I think that kind of comes with a just hierarchy, is that maybe you want one that distributes the wealth, fruit, the profits of large-scale society more fairly. But I don't think that means, personally, I don't think that means you need to do away with any hierarchy. I just think you need to think about how to make that hierarchy accountable and fair.
Okay.
That was the University of Auckland's Quentin Atkinson.
That was The Wire.
Koe rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, LGBTQIA+ activist Lauren Craig, Kirsten Tillerman, a PhD researcher at the University of Auckland, and University of Auckland Professor of Psychology Quentin Atkinson. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the Wednesday 1 to 4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.